So Article 25 reads, the office, I'm just going to read the redacted version of 1914, you can just compare. The office peculiar to the deacons is diligently to collect alms and other contributions of charity, and after mutual counsel, faithfully and diligently to distribute the same to the poor as their needs may require it, to visit and comfort the distressed, and to exercise care that the alms are not misused, of which they shall render an account in consistory, and also, if anyone desires to be present, to the congregation at such a time as the consistory may see fit. Now, this is basically a summary of the duties of the deacons. First of all, you notice how that charity, alms, are not just in the form of money. It says to collect alms and other contributions of charity. So as we talked about before, people could donate food, could donate literature, land, other things of value. Mutual counsel is what strikes us next, showing that we are to, deacons aren't supposed to act unilaterally on their own. It's always a matter of consultation with the other deacons in order to preserve fidelity and remove any appearance of evil. And then I noticed that there is a difference, you'll notice, between the church order of 1618-19 and the redacted, and I prefer the original, where it talks about distributing to the poor both to residents and to strangers. The updated version just speaks about the poor in a general sort of way. Do you have a page for Alan? He could...
182.
Sorry about that. The scripture is full of mention of strangers, how the saint should be taking care of them. For example, Galatians 6:10, there is a priority for the household of faith. But nevertheless, that verse does include others. And there are several passages in Scripture that speak about the care of strangers. I have listed a number of them. Deuteronomy 10:17-19, Deuteronomy 14:28-29, Jeremiah 7:5-7, Malachi 3:5, Hebrews 13:2, entertaining strangers, so to speak. And that is, of course, something that needs to be done with care, because there's a lot of people today, it seems, who are just looking for a handout. It's interesting, I had a conversation with a gentleman who owns the store next door to us, and he said he's had lots of requests for help. He's never had one person volunteer to actually work for the handout they're asking for. Which in old days used to be standard practice. Is there something I can do for you to earn a little money? Today they forego the work and just look for the handout. So, and then also notice how it talks about, in addition to the distribution of alms to the poor, visiting and comforting the distressed. So a person doesn't necessarily have to be in financial need. A person could be in a hospital. A person could be just really having a difficult time for one reason or another. That certainly is fair game, not only for elders but deacons, to see that they're doing all right, but also to comfort them spiritually. And of course, to be careful that the almsgiving isn't misused. That hints, of course, that badly they are to be faithful in their handling of the funds, but they are to try to see to it that people don't abuse the gifts that they receive through mismanagement and poor money handling skills. So education, again, is a part of the work of the deacon. Now the last clause, talking about giving an account, we do that here, of course, through the financial statements that the deacons provide us, and of course, we could always ask any questions we want just recognizing there's a certain propriety and confidentiality we should respect as far as the recipients of the help. But then as far as the congregation being involved, that doesn't mean that upon request the congregation can know who we helped and to what extent we helped them. But there should be a general oversight by the congregation of the deacons, in the sense that, you know, financial reports are given of a general nature, just to make sure that everything's on the up and up. There's no collusion within the council or consistory, that sort of thing. Here it mentions that it's something requested by the members of the congregation. I think it's always best to be proactive in that respect, and even if people don't ask to see the books or whatever, to present occasional updates so that people know where things stand and what needs there might be. And that's one last thing I want to mention. It's not in the article. I've actually seen it a number of times in church life. There's an expression, when the people of God know the need, they'll respond. And often where I see committees of classes and synod fail, and even deacons sometimes fail, is simply not acquainting the people of God of a need in a timely enough way. There's committees, they wait till they're desperate for funds and they send out a frantic letter of, you know, for help. It really shouldn't be that way. Planned giving is always the best kind. It gives the people of God an opportunity to prepare their gifts. Paul speaks about that. He wanted the Christians to have their gifts prepared ahead of time, before he came, so there wouldn't be gatherings for that purpose when he came. So there should be timely notices. For particularly special offerings, I would suggest, if you know enough forethought can be given, two bulletin announcements, two consecutive Sundays before the Sunday that the offering, the special offering would be taken, if possible, would be helpful. Because then if people need to liquidate investments or whatever for a special cause, they have opportunity. Many times today you can't just pull funds out of your sock, so to speak, and dump them into the offering plate. If it's a sizable need and people have sizable funds, it's often invested, and it takes some time sometimes to get that loose from the vehicle it's tied up in. Any questions or comments on that, Article 25? Okay, let's move to Article 26 then. Alan, would you mind closing that door? I feel like a constant draft coming in the front. The original article is much more brief than the redaction. Let me just read the redaction here. In places where others are devoting themselves to the care of the poor, the deacon shall seek a mutual understanding with them to the end that the alms may all the better be distributed among those who have the greatest need. Let me just pause there a minute. What's talked about there is when you have other institutions, other bodies, other persons that are dedicated to the needs of the poor. So, for example, social workers might be involved, or other organizations or funds or such things. If possible, it's good to keep up a correspondence or at least an understanding with them. And of course, the reason is obvious, right? You don't want to have duplication of services. So if they're already receiving assistance, it'd be helpful to know the extent of that assistance, so you're not necessarily overlapping the assistance given. Maybe you could help in other ways that aren't being addressed, that sort of thing. This way deacons can reserve their help to those who have the greatest need, the redaction talks about. The old version talks about visitants to shut-ins and other almoners. So if you know of people in the congregation who are visiting shut-ins or sick people on a regular basis, I've known such people, retirees, godly retirees, would make the rounds among the widows and things. It's good to keep in touch with them, to find out if they have learned anything that might be of help to you. So that's kind of what that's talking about. Then it says, moreover, they shall make it possible for the poor to make use of institutions of mercy. And to that end, they shall request the board of directors of such institutions to keep in close touch with them. I might have mentioned it to you at one time when I was a deacon. I actually sat on a board of directors for an old age home that most of our people in church used, Pine Haven Christian Home. I still remember the name of it. And it had representation on the board from all the supporting churches. So there were about 20 of us there. But it was really good because not only, you know, did we keep in touch with our folks who lived there, but we also were able to get a sense of how the institution was doing, what the needs of the institution as a whole were. Now, I'm not saying you have to be on boards of directors or such things, but it is a good idea if our people are involved in different organizations or whatever to kind of keep in touch how they're doing, what's being done for them. Is there anything we can do for that institution? And that's pretty much Article 26. Basically, keeping in touch with institutions outside of ourselves. Now, Article 27... Oh, any questions on 26 as far as that goes? Yeah.
When I look at these articles... And I study history and the effects of the Reformation to restore the office and practice of the deacons. I'm amazed at how even culturally in the last 100 years maybe, that on the one hand how the Reformation had permeated general cultural consciousness such to the extent that the idea of the almoner, the illuminacenary activity of the deacons in the church was a generally known thing. It was even in law dictionaries and things. And now because of modernism, post-postmodernism, we've lost that. And it's a huge function of the church. Mm-hmm. And we have an uphill battle, really, to fight against that resistance and lack of consciousness of that, but it's a huge opportunity because there's a lot of people to be reached through the church in that area, and really thankful that we're talking about this and that it's part of being covenantal, it's part of being reformed, it's part really of the gospel, you know, the whole counsel of God, and it's to a great extent been lost, but pray God will use the church to reinstitute that.
Okay, thank you. I just want to say a couple things to dovetail what Michael just mentioned. First of all, I remember as a deacon sometimes scratching my head and thinking, is there anything left for us to do? Because there seems to be a government program or state program or local program for practically everything. But I think what Michael mentioned brings up two things. One, I think it's fair to say that by and large, it was the church's falling down on the job as far as the practice of the deaconry that opened a wide field for the world to step in. Same thing is true for Christian education. It used to be that most churches offered education, or at least assisted parents in education. The public school system has filled a vacuum. That being said, though, I think we have to look at the overarching picture, the spiritual warfare that's going on a broader scale, and that is Satan would love to displace, as Michael pointed out, the church from the scene, so to speak. And by the government seeming to be determined at this point in history to get more and more people addicted to its care, even for political purposes, it's making our work all the more challenging. The only thing is, though, they can't really compete on a level playing field with us, because if you've ever dealt with government agencies, by and large, they're pretty heartless, they're pretty cold, they're very impersonal. It's a rare day, unless you find a godly social worker, where you're dealing with anyone who reflects the love of Christ. So we have something to offer that I think, you know, ironically, as the world gets more aggressive in getting people addicted to it, people get less and less used to the love of Christ. We have something that could really excite them. Alan?
Also, another point is that in most of these government things, they take and expect the people to come to them with everything, and they do not seek them at all, whereas we go and we meet them where they are and say, what can we do to help? How can we help you? And that's a big difference too on that personal level, because I've never seen a social worker or somebody really going after the people that need the help and seeing them when they need it and knowing before anybody else really even knows to try to help them.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point.
I just had one other point.
Sure.
It's just a, I don't know if you have the interest in reading further, a little bit more of a Reconstructionist viewpoint, but George Grant wrote a book called Bringing in the Sheaves, Transforming Poverty into Productivity. And when we have an increasing level of unemployment and sort of a, why should I do anything about, you know, enterprising and working, you know, because I can get a disability check or whatever. I mean, and some have legitimate needs. It is an opportunity for the gospel to, you know, address that foothold, you know, that Satan has established in the world to, you know, cause people to live ungodly.
Thank you, man. Let's move to Article 27. It's a somewhat different subject, of course, and that is concerning the terms of office. The elders and deacons shall serve 2 or more years according to local regulations, and a proportionate number shall retire each year. Retiring officers shall be succeeded by others, unless the circumstances and profit of any church in the execution of Articles 22 and 24 render a re-election advisable. So, the original church order stipulated half of the number needing to retire, and the redaction, I think wisely, talked about a proportionate number, so you could have a third retiring each year, a quarter retiring each year. I think they recognized over the years that continuity in office bearing is very helpful. You may recall in our June 2011 now members meeting, we did opt to do the half retirement way, and that's going to be something we discuss today, how to implement that while staggering the terms of our elders and deacons, so we don't end up with, you know, everybody retiring at the same time, which would be somewhat disastrous. So the clause at the end, of course, in smaller churches, in churches with a lack of qualified persons for office, then certainly the circumstances and profit of the church would dictate that people be re-elected to office rather than putting up nominating people who are unqualified biblically for an office. So that's something to keep in mind too. That really has to trump the term limit thing. You can't put up people who aren't fit for the office just to fulfill the term limit part. You have to have qualified people. If you do, then giving office bearers a rest from time to time is a wise thing. Is a desirable thing, but certainly not at the peril of the profit of the church. Any questions on that? Okay, and that will be all for today on these.